You may be seated. Our next case is 13-586, Carlos Civit et al. Versus the Village of Green Beechwood. For the appellant, Mr. Karp.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. I wonder if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May the court please. My name is Marvin Karp. I'd like to focus on two main points here this morning. First is the erroneous way in which the 8th District misinterpreted and misapplied Revised Code 23-15-21, which, as the court is well aware, is a statute that imposes a cap on punitive damages. It's clear from the legislative history that the legislative intent in enacting this statute was to limit punitive damages in Ohio. The 8th District's interpretation, however, did exactly the opposite. It expanded punitive damages in Ohio. 8th District's interpretation did this by holding that the CAPS provision has no application whatever to any claim for tortious conduct in which the parties had a contractual relationship, and hence which the duty breached by the defendant arose out of contractual relationship. We call these cases hybrid cases, or at least I do, because it encompasses, it means that the particular conduct of the defendant gave rise to both a claim for breach of contract and a tort claim. We point out in our brief there are a whole raft of cases that fall within this hybrid category.
What's the tort claim?
I'm sorry?
What's the tort claim?
The tort claim?
Yes.
In this case?
Yes.
The tort claim is the claim that is under Revised Code 532104, the Landlord-Tenant Act, which this court has repeatedly held gives rise to claims for negligence per se. And indeed, just less than a month ago, In Your Honor's opinion in Mann against Northgate Investors, you reiterated this rule and pointed out in that case that that ever since 1983, Schrodes against Rental Homes, this court has held that when a landlord is held liable for damages for violating 532104, the landlord is being held liable in tort.
Okay, and the contract claim is what?
Well, the contract claim, according to the defendant, according to the appellees, is that the obligations imposed by the statute are deemed to be implied provisions of the rental agreement between the landlord and tenant. And therefore, if the landlord fails to comply with the statute, failing to maintain the premises in a proper condition, the landlord has violated the implied terms of the contract. That's supposedly the contract claim. We submit that the reasoning here of the Court of Appeals is simply erroneous, and it is circular. Because if you hold that these hybrid claims, and I might, as I was going to mention, what certain these hybrid claims are, for example, the tort claims by employees against employers for retaliatory discharge, sexual discrimination, harassment, et cetera, claims against insurance companies for bad faith, failing to comply with the provisions of contract, and of course, actions under this statute. If you hold, as the 8th District suggests, that because they arise out of contractual relationship, these are breach of contract claims, then there should be no punitive damages at all. Because this court has held for over 100 years, you can't have punitive damages in breach of contract cases. But the 8th District says, oh no, the breach here was tortious conduct, and therefore was a tortious breach, and therefore what the defendant is being held liable for here is tortious conduct, not breach of contract, to which
counsel,
we said.
Counsel, if we consider, just on that punitive damages question, aren't there cases that say you can separate out the breach of contract claims on which you would not be able to have punitive damages from the tortious claims on which you would be able to have punitive damages?
Surely.
So in looking at the jury interrogatories and looking at the verdict that we have here, is there any way to distinguish that in this case?
We don't have to distinguish that because the fact is that they didn't hold one way or the other. The jury was instructed, for example, that in order to prove, hold the defendant liable in this case for negligence, all of the things they had to prove in order to prove a violation of the statute. There wasn't a word in the jury instructions about breach of contract. It was strictly all negligence.
So I'm understanding, Mr. Karp.
Yes, sir.
That you are not contesting the determination that this was a tort.
No, I am not.
And therefore, the application of the statute limiting punitive damages should apply to this case. That's where you're headed.
Basically, that is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And what would be the, I'm sorry.
Were go you ahead. Not, yeah, go ahead, Justice.
And what would be the bottom line then in terms of the caps on damages? Does it apply? There are several people involved here.
Well,
so how do you? They awarded $2 million, and what's allowed? And if you're arguing that the caps apply, what's allowed in this case?
Punitive damages were assessed against only one of the two defendants, and the amount of compensatory damages against that defendant was a shade under $600,000. And therefore, we say if the caps were imposed and punitive damages were allowed, a point which I'll get to in a moment, if punitive damages were proper in this case, punitive damages should have been limited to, round numbers, $1,200,000, two times compensatory damages.
So that would be $800,000 should be taken off of this?
That is correct.
All right.
And does it matter that there are two defendants and that only one of them, they both were liable for the compensatory, but only one is liable for the punitives? Does that matter?
Doesn't matter. Okay. With respect to punitive damages, beyond the caps issue, we submit that the court erred in submitting punitive damages at all to the jury. Which that brings me to my second main point, which is where and how this particular fire started. That fact is central, not only to our second proposition of law, but as well as to our third. Where the fire started was in this 16-inch space, immediately above apartment 210 and immediately below apartment 310. In that space, only thing that was in that space were three wires. And those wires were stapled to the ceiling joists. The expert's opinion was that the fire started, A, that's where it started, and B, the only way it could have started is if something went wrong with that wire, at one of those wires, which had been there for 13 years. And his opinion was that the most probable cause is what went wrong is that one of these staples ultimately worked their way through the insulation until the metal of the staple hit the metal part of the wire and you had a spark and you had a fire. And we say, fine. That's the opinion, that's the testimony. And it means that's where the fire started, but it also means that this particular locale was totally outside of the view of the landlord. The landlord could have walked through there every day for 13 years and never seen this. It was totally hidden. Which brings us to this court's decision in Malone against Courtyard against Marriott, where this court held that in order to impose punitive damages and to find actual malice, conscious disregard of the rights and safety of others, the plaintiff must prove that the defendant had actual knowledge of the dangerous condition and then fail to take the appropriate steps to correct it as a result of which injury occurred. We say that couldn't have happened here because there's no way in the world that the landlord could have been aware what was going on in that interstitial space, 16 inches space.
Was there some testimony that there'd been water problems and that there'd been calls made on issues in this particular area of the
over a span of 13 years, there were sporadic problems that you would inspect in an apartment building this size. This is an apartment complex, you maybe recall, of 11 buildings, 360 units.
Hadn't another one of the buildings burned?
Yeah, building number 3, 4 years before, there was a fire.
Was there an origin determination on that?
Disputed. The expert said he thought it was electrical in some way, but there was so much destruction he couldn't tell what had transpired. The defendant's expert said it was exterior. It was a different type of cause.
So your opponent, counsel, will indicate that this should put the landlord on notice of electrical difficulties with respect to this complex.
One could say that. But
I think we're going to hear it.
You're definitely going to hear it, Your Honor. The problem is what should be done? What is reasonable to be done under 53-2104? we point out in our brief that the exact same thing that happened here, and I'll get back to Your Honor's point in a moment, but this ties right into it. The exact same thing that happened here occurred in Abbott against Haight Properties. That's the Sixth District decision back around 2000. And exactly, you had a fire in an apartment building. They do expert determined that it was caused because a staple wore its way through the insulation of a wire, and that caused the fire. The only difference between Abbott case and this case is that that wire, where the staple wore its way through, was behind a wall. In our case, it's above the ceiling. The Sixth District said you can't hold a landlord liable for this. The only way the landlord could have prevented this from happening was at some point gone through and ripped holes in all of the walls in this apartment building and looked at all the wires behind the walls and tried to ascertain whether a staple was working its way through. The word that was used by the Sixth District was it's nonsensical, which brings us to the point here.
But wouldn't the inspection at the time of the installation have, if it was properly inspected, guarded against that?
I would, Your Honor, I would frankly doubt it. We're talking about tens of thousands of staples. You're talking about miles and miles of wires. So you've got staples stapling up to the joists, to the studs behind the wall where you're feeding, you know, your base plugs and things of that nature. There are thousands of staples. Is somebody going to go through there and see, well, let's see whether or not this staple may be touching the insulation? Is it touching it enough? It just is not a reason.
But, counsel, wasn't there a finding by the trial court and by the Court of Appeals that Building 8 was negligently constructed?
Negligently constructed? We don't think so, but there was a jury. You can make that determination.
No, I know you don't think so, but I'm asking, didn't the court find that it was negligently constructed, and didn't they add the element of water between the two ceilings?
Oh, we're not aware of any water going between the going above the ceiling of
I thought the detective said that the wiring in the space was damped and moist and that there was arcing.
I do not believe that is an accurate reflection of the testimony. There was testimony, for example, with respect to the 8th District, who said, well, it makes no difference that the landlord couldn't see what was up above here because this building was in disrepair. And to support this, the 8th District, in its opinion, and it's in several places in its opinion, refers to a letter that was received from the City of Beechwood Building Department a year before the fire. The letter, incidentally, we've attached it as pages 1-2 of the supplement to our brief. If you look at that letter, the letter simply points out, is my mic on or off at the moment?
It just went off.
Okay. That the letter refers to defects in the exterior of Building 8. It refers to deteriorated siding, missing brick veneer, missing gutters, lack of paint job.
Well, I mean, some of those things could attribute to dampness between the floors and water, creeping in and getting making its way
outside, but it is no attribute of anything that the deteriorated siding, which was not repaired, or the missing brick veneer, which was not repaired, or the missing gutters had anything to do with the start of the fire, which was in this very limited space above apartment 210. And that's where it started. There's nothing there other than the wires. There's no evidence that water is flowing through there at all.
So, Mr. Karp, are you limiting the actual notice of the landlord to the cause of the fire? Is that your position, that the landlord needs to know the actual inception of the problem, that the actual notice of the staples or whatever caused the fire? And if the landlord didn't know that, then there's no actual knowledge?
No, Justice Lansinger. My position is that the landlord had to have some knowledge that something was wrong up there in that space. Whatever it was is immaterial. But if the landlord had some knowledge of some kind that something was wrong with one of those wires, the landlord had an obligation to go in there, rip open the ceiling, and find out what was going on.
And without that, you could not be found to have acted with actual malice, which would allow for punitives. But you're going further in saying you can't even be found liable. Is that it?
Yes. That goes to my third point, which is 532104, as the court aware, is not a strict liability statute. It's a negligence statute. In order to find a landlord liable for compensatory damages under 532104, which is our third proposition of law, for compensatory damages, the landlord has to have had knowledge, actual or even constructive, that something was wrong and in disrepair. Two, that the landlord then failed to do what was reasonably necessary to correct that condition. And third, the failure of the landlord to do what was reasonably necessary to correct that condition caused the loss.
Counsel, maybe we're looking at a different record, you and I. I'm looking at testimony of the witnesses that were talking about water running between the walls and that the landlord was told there's water coming in through the walls and it's waterlogged. Am I looking at a different case?
We're looking at 11 buildings, Your Honor, and we're looking at a building that has 32 apartments, and there is no testimony that water was running above the ceiling.
Oh, I see. You're saying in the ceiling of building or apartment 210.
That's correct. There's no water running through there.
Okay.
So what? It was happening over the other side of the building. That's maybe isn't very nice, but this is a very expensive development. People are paying good money to live in. This is not some shack someplace. And we can't help it. Problems are out of disrepair, but a landlord should not be held liable for punitive damages in any case simply because you look through and you say, oh, over here, there was something wrong and out of disrepair. Ergo, you're liable for punitive damages.
Counsel, so I can understand, so we can all understand your position. In your conclusion of your brief, you ask us at a minimum to apply caps on punitives.
That's correct. Step one.
And secondly, if that's all the further we go, I take it the attorney fees that were awarded, you're not contesting.
We say the attorney fees, we did contest them, but for reasons that we didn't discuss here in the brief. But we say if all punitive damages are knocked out for reason of the Malone against Courtyard Marriott
case, then the attorney fees go as well.
Attorney fees goes as well.
All right.
And then thirdly, compensatory damages for the reasons I've discussed.
Right.
I think my time has expired, Your Honor.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Dimmert.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor and distinguished justices of this Ohio Supreme Court, my esteemed counsel. With me is my associate, Daniel Powell, and behind me are the tenants who were in the building in question, including Ananya Marathe, who's in the front row, who's the 13-year-old girl who saw the glow outside her window in the middle of the night, woke up her mother, ran out to the hallway, and because the fire alarms were not working properly because of all the electrical and water problems, started banging on every door in the 30-suite apartment building to save their lives. We're proud of that girl, but we're also proud that during the two-week trial, the jury made a decision that was a very strong decision, a very right decision. All of the appellant's arguments must have come from a different record because they're not substantiated. If you read our brief, we have documented more evidence, abundance of evidence, overflowing evidence to contradict everything that was said here today. And I don't want to repeat all of that in the brief. I'd rather get to the arguments that I think are important for this court. But the arguments, again, of the appellant were rejected by 8 jurors, rejected by a trial judge, rejected by 3 panel court of appeals, and a 12 and bank decision to not accept it.
Can you tell me? Go ahead.
Could I ask one question? Did the evidence in the record show any actual notice regarding apartment 210? I know that there's statements that in other buildings and other apartments there were problems, but was there anything that talked about this particular area being the subject of complaints?
Yes, there was. The tenant above smelled smoke, had heard of problems before, had heard water in the walls. The lady in the apartment before underneath that had flickering lights, had repeatedly made complaints about that.
And that was from for a period of time, how much before the actual?
During the 2 year prior to that fire.
Okay, so the record will show
that the record will show that, yes. But more importantly, what the record shows is that there was a huge amount of problems in the first building that burned in 2004. And remarkably, it was in the same location, above 210, below 310, the same area. But what was found by the expert in the 04 fire investigation and the fire marshal and the fire inspectors from the city of Beechwood, four different entities inspecting this from the state of Ohio, from the city, and an independent investigator, all concluded shoddy workmanship, negligent workmanship, lack of maintenance, and even their own engineer testified at court that he found 13 years of neglect. And this was his employer that he's talking about. 13 years of continuous capital neglect, all kinds of water running through it. The testimony of their supervisor of maintenance, Mr. Farlow, you will find in the record. He testified that he told the owners repeatedly, this building is waterlogged, building 8. He was supervisor for all of the buildings. He testified that it was waterlogged, that there were electrical components being shed upon water. It wasn't one staple. There were thousands of staples that were put in wrong. There were hundreds of photographs given to the jury by our expert witness and the city's expert and the marshal that were given to the jury to see. There was no expert on behalf of the appellants who said anything contradictory.
Mr. Diemert, let's talk about the question of law your opposing counsel has raised.
Yes, Your Honor.
He suggests that this is a contract claim and therefore that punitive damages should be capped.
I disagree, of course, Your Honor, and I suggest to this court that the appellees are seeking for this court to do a simple thing, emphatically and affirm and jealously safeguard the jury verdict of December 11, 2011, by applying the plain language of the statutes 2315.21 and 5321.04. That's a one-sentence decision that we feel would say it all. And 1 month ago, this court, in its opinion, authored by Judge Pfeiffer, clearly upheld the negligence per se aspect of the landlord-tenant law, and that public safety laws are meant for one reason, the safety of the tenants. In that Mann decision, Justice Pfeiffer wrote, the words of the statute tell the tale, and I want you to determine that 5321.04A was sufficiently specific to find negligence per se in this case. But if you take that same decision that you just made, and you apply it to this case, we suggest that this honorable court will find that 2315.21 will also come to the decision that the words of the statute tell the tale. The definition of the tort action under 2315 specifically excludes a breach of contract or another agreement between persons. Now, if you have that language of the legislature clearly and unambiguously setting forth the standard for what tort is being capped, they clearly do not want contracts or agreements between parties to be capped.
Is this a tort claim, then, or a contract claim in your view?
This is a tort claim that originates by reason of a rental agreement with the landlord.
All right. And if it's a tort claim, if I understood Mr. Karp's argument, he said the statute says that punitive damages are limited to twice the amount of the compensatory. Do you agree with that statement?
I agree that that language is there, but the sentence is not completed, except where the tort is based upon an agreement between parties. I believe his definition of tort is his definition of tort, but the definition the state legislature gave to a tort is different. And it's interesting to look in the legislative history. You'll find no mention that they ever talked about the landlord-tenant being the target in these cases. As a matter of fact, the statute of repose, adopted by the same Tort Reform 3, excluded landlord-tenant cases specifically from that 10-year statute of limitations protection. So the legislature was not focusing on the landlord-tenant situations in this case or in any others. So we feel that the court, in the Mann decision, was giving construction to a statute that the legislature cannot be presumed to have wanted their words to mean anything other than what they said. For you to strike the words or agreement between parties, you are legislatively amending the statute. And that would then take away the meaning of what the state legislature's duties are.
But counsel, if we agree with that interpretation, doesn't that mean that you don't get punitives at all? If we call this a contract action, then why are the punitive damages appropriate?
Justice French, we have repeated cases where you have held that the landlord-tenant law violations are negligence per se, which is a tort. And it becomes a tort because of the negligence of the landlord. And if you were to say to the landlords, okay, look it, you can't really be punished with punitive damages here. You can only be punished to the extent of even the caps. Well, then there's going to be a balancing act of the landlords in this state. What's our exposure? What are we standing to lose if we don't fix this building? Well, I'll tell you what they lost. They made $5.8 million because of their own engineer's investigation. He found 13 years of neglect. $5.8 million was subtracted from their buyout of their minority partner. In addition, they settled the insurance claim on this building for $3.6 million more than they paid to reconstruct the building.
That's not in the record. What we're trying to do is figure out the nature of the claim, your position as to the nature of the claim, and the application of the punitive damage statute. Could you confine your response to that?
The nature of the claim?
Yes.
Yes. Well,
you keep saying it's negligence per se, which is a tort. You agree with that?
Yes.
But what is the implication that it's a tort then, as terms of application of punitive damages?
It's a negligence.
Are they not limited to twice the amount of the compensatory by statute?
By reason of 2315.21's definition of what a tort is. A tort is an action against others for damages that you have sustained, except if it's a contract between parties or an agreement between others.
All right, I don't think we're getting anywhere. Maybe you don't understand the question, or I'm not asking it right. But
sure.
You don't agree that there's a cap on damages then?
Not for a tort that is based upon a contractual relationship.
All right. Thank you.
If that's am I getting it to the right spot, Justice O'Donnell?
I understand your answer.
And I'm still a little at sea on this. I'm obviously, I've spoken to my thoughts on the legislature capping damages, but they did it, and it's been upheld. Isn't it reasonable to also read it as making a reference to what Justice French is referring to, as you don't get punitives in contract cases?
And that has been the law, that in according to the digital case, in most contract situations, you don't get punitive damages. However, the state...
So that's what I'm wondering. You read it one way, but is it not reasonable to read it as this is just a reference to the fact that if it's a contract, then punitives aren't in it at all?
Then the state legislature would have no reason to have put those words in there, unless it's a contract or agreement between parties would be superfluous.
Well, because they don't trust us, would be why they put them in. I mean, they don't trust the common law at all. It's clear.
But we have
that they don't.
But we have to trust that they knew what they were saying and the words that they were using. They specifically excluded landlord tenants from the statute of repose. They specifically included products liability. They specifically have motor vehicle accidents, discrimination cases, products liability cases for sure. Everything where there's no contract or agreement between parties involved, they wanted to cap those limits. But they knew there were hybrid contract cases where punitive damages were allowed, because we have decades and many decades of case law that says you can get damages under certain contract cases.
But is that because the contract allows it, or because there's also a parallel claim that it's, we keep using the word hybrid, which to me means a complete melding of the two claims, but in those punitive damages cases, the court was saying, over here you do have a breach of contract claim, which does not give rise to punitives, but you also have a tort claim, which can give rise. And because we've got both of those claims in this case, we can say that punitives are proper because they arise from the tort claim. I guess I'm surprised that that's not what you're arguing, that we had both in this case somehow. And so you can look at the punitives and attach them only to the tort claim. But instead, what I hear you saying is, for purposes of the caps, this is a contract action. For purposes of the punitives, it's a tort action. That's what I'm hearing.
I'm sorry. Then I have not made myself clear in our brief. We'll clarify it even more. We are not saying that this is a contract case. This case, I think, fits like a glove into what the state legislature was thinking of when they exempted agreements between parties. When a landlord signs a rental agreement, he is agreeing to be bound by 5321 and all of the obligations that come with that. And a breach of those statutory requirements has been held by this court to be negligence per se. Well, negligence per se is a tort. The violation of the statute is the tort. We never brought in one agreement and said they breached our contract. Not one lease agreement was brought into evidence.
But let me give you another example that they could have been thinking of, and maybe this isn't a good one. Your stockbroker commits fraud, but there's an agreement that all disputes between you and your stockbroker are arbitrated. It's industry standard. Could that be the kind of thing they're referring to?
Well, I think that could be included.
Because if you know your fraud case, you could get punitives.
Yes, and
but you've got this contract that says you don't get to sue them at all.
Well, it's an agreement between parties, but if they committed a fraud, that is a statutory violation. And I think that is a very good parallel. We have more than an agreement between parties. We have a statutory obligation that has been breached that results in negligence per se, upon which there should be no limit on caps, and there should be allowed punitive damages.
Does the lease say anything about punitive damages in the event of a suit between the parties?
Does not.
Thank you.
But it does incorporate the Ohio Revised Code as being the obligations of the tenant in fulfilling the right for a tenant to have peaceful and quiet enjoyment of its particular premises.
You're suggesting that any tort that comes from a duty of a statute should be treated differently? Is that what you're saying?
If it is incorporated by reason of an agreement, we have an agreement between a party.
So, for example, when Mr. Karp referred to like a termination case, a wrongful termination, or any claim there that relates to a contract and giving rise to any type of negligence or breach of duty, you would say that is outside the statute?
If there's an agreement between the parties in writing, I would say is a reasonable place for this court to draw the line on a case-by-case basis, if you so chose. But this case is so clearly an agreement that incorporates a statutory obligation. If you have an employment agreement and it's in writing and your employer steps outside into statutory violations, it could be a parallel situation where the tort caps would not apply because there was an agreement. The employer tried to take advantage of that agreement, stepped outside the agreement, and breached statutory violations imposed upon him, then yes, I would think that the punitive damages should be allowed.
We haven't discussed, Mr. Karp said he didn't deal with that, the attorney fees. An award was made of reasonable attorney fees. Was that based on a contingent fee contract, or was that based on hourly? How did that award?
Yes, there was a several-day hearing wherein which the Lodestar billable hours testimony, an expert lawyer testified on behalf of the fees being reasonable and necessary. There was no opposition lawyer's testimony as to the reasonableness of the fees. There was a contingent fee agreement. These folks would not have had the wherewithal to have this
sure.
matter handled over 7 years without someone willing to take it on themselves. So the judge, based on strong case law, issued an opinion, and after a separate 2-3 day hearing, and hearing all the evidence and testimony, and determined that the upcharge on the Lodestar was appropriate, and issued that order. So my understanding is that part has not been appealed, but if you knock out punitives, then I suppose it would be.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Karp, you may take 30 seconds.
The attorney's fees were 40% exactly of the total compensatory and punitive damages. With respect to the statutory language, you know, that language that Mr. Demut talked about, which is that tort action means a civil action for damages for injury to person or property, but does not include a civil action for a damage of damages for a breach of contract or another agreement between persons. Where that language came from? It's been there since 1988. In the Tort Reform 1, it was there. In Tort Reform 1, when they talked about punitive damages, which says, you know, it can only be decided by the judge rather than by a jury. It was continued in Tort Reform 2, and it continued here. Same exact language. And I often wondered myself, what's that language doing there? And my conclusion was much like Justice Pfeiffer said a moment ago, is that the legislature wanted to make darn sure that by enacting a statute dealing with punitive damages, that no one would interpret it as meaning that it was knocking out this common law rule that you don't get punitive damages in a breach of contract case. And therefore, they put this language in to make that clear.
But when you refer to Tort Reform 1, you're talking about something that was declared unconstitutional.
That
right?
is right.
All right. So.
And tort reform, too.
And you're. Okay.
But they kept that same language when they did not enact tort reform.
Well, that's because that's what Harry Layman gave them.
Well, your knowledge in that area is way beyond mine, Justice Pfeiffer.
All right.
I don't know. One further point with respect to the activities in the apartment 310. The record showed that there was only one thing went wrong electrically in apartment 210, and that was a light fixture didn't work. It was fixed, and nothing happened since then. I think it is significant if you read Appley's brief, they never mention where this fire started. And I think that's a significant omission because the Court of Appeals in a paragraph 6, 26 and 36 very specifically said the fire started in this space above apartment 210. Why didn't they mention it? Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decisions. Marshall, will you please adjourn?